all owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Welcome to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Here at American Warrior Radio, we see it as our mission, our duty, to tell the stories of the men and women who protect us at home and abroad. Now, ideally, we have them as guests on our show to tell their own stories, but the practical reality is that for World War II and the Korean War generation, that is becoming more and more difficult to do. We are proud to have had veterans like Dick Cole, the last of the Doolittle Raiders, and Doug Dillard, who survived the Battle of the Bulge and went on to lead soldiers in both Korea and Vietnam. Both those warriors have completed their last patrol and passed on. The commitment to tell their stories does not die with the warriors. In fact, I believe it only reinforces the importance of continuing to record them, to share them with future generations. Today, I'm excited to be joined by three other individuals whom each in their own way are allies in fulfilling that mission. We're going to focus on one particular World War II unit, a group that has become one of the best known due to a book and an HBO series. They are the men of E Company, 2nd Battalion of the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment of the 101st Airborne Division. You may know them as the Band of Brothers. Joining us first, we have I don't want to say amateur historian, but quite the historian in her own right, Suzanne Ryan. She's a board member of Honor Flight of Southern Arizona and also a member of the Daughters of American Revolution. I literally, folks, if you could see the studio, I've got a stack of books in here about World War II that Suzanne has been involved with. Suzanne, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Speak up. Don't be shy.
Okay.
There's thousands of people listening, but don't let that make you nervous.
Just want to make one slight correction.
Oh, okay.
I'm former board member of Honor Flight.
All right. Fair enough. Ben gets to ask dumb questions. Ben gets to make mistakes because I pay for the show. What your interest in World War history started at a very young age,
Yes. Generally.
Tell us about how you first got hooked.
I don't know how it came about. It just came about very intrinsically. I can remember being a very little girl and fascinated by the war movies that my dad was watching, Midway. And when I was about 12 or 13, it was my mother who first verbalized my interest. She noticed that I always got really excited when it was time to study the World Wars in school. And then I remember she went to her closet and she pulled out her one relic that she had, which was her ration stamps. And she put them in my hand.
Uh-huh.
And the chills that went through my body holding this artifact from there. I was hooked. I don't have a direct relative that fought. My dad was too young. Actually, one time I asked my dad, did you fight in the war, World War II? And he said, no. And I said, why not? And he said, because I was too young. And I said, well, that's no excuse. I think I hurt his feelings a little bit.
Maybe. We might be about the same age. My folks were too young to have served, but my mother's told me stories. She was raised in California. And in particular, a lot of her classmates were sent off to the camps. There were Japanese families who were sent off to the camps. And even as a child, she must have been, I don't know, 8 or 9 at the time, how much that hurt her and how much that still, till her dying day, would make her angry about the way we treated our fellow citizens when it came to those internment camps. So a lot of folks take an interest in World War II history. I do. But you have taken this to an extreme. You lead tours. Normandy, you actually moved and spent some time there. What kind of bravery does it take to open a taco shop in the Netherlands?
Bravery or stupidity? I'm not quite sure. I moved over there in 2016, and my friend had told me, you know, the Dutch don't hire people over 50. And I said, well, I'm not going to have a problem finding a job. I have a great resume. But I ended up finding that to be the case. So I said, well, I'll probably have to make my own way there. And opening a restaurant was kind of always a bucket list thing for me. Mm-hmm. I always pictured it would be some cute little breakfast place on a beach somewhere, not necessarily a Mexican restaurant in the Netherlands, but that's how it happened. And, you know, the Dutch have a fascination with Mexican food. So I did my research. I knew I could do it. I lucked out being in the right place, right time, and found some people who were opening up a gourmet food market, which was a new concept for them and pitched my concept because I'd already written my business plan, and the rest was history.
Now, we're going to be speaking mostly about Easy Company here, and again, most of our listeners probably would recognize them from the Band of Brothers series or the book if they read it. Eindhoven and the not quite so successful bid to end World War II early is a big part of their story,
it
of
is.
Easy Company's story. Yeah. So was that in the back of your mind when you moved over there? Or because you've led several tours of Normandy and D-Day landing sites.
Yeah.
So what? Give me the timeline here.
Well, I already had quite a contingency of friends over in the Netherlands because of my World War research and volunteer work. So the Eindhoven, I actually lived just outside of Eindhoven, but I was thrilled to be there, to live on the land that these events happened. So I knew that I could continue my volunteer work while over there. You know, the Dutch and the Belgians and the French are very, a lot of Americans don't know this. They really do care about our veterans. The Dutch at our American cemetery in Margraten have adopted 100% of the graves and the names on the wall of missing there. And every year they participate in our Memorial Day, our Veterans Day. They hold huge wreath-laying ceremonies. They go and they tend to the graves. They research, try and find family members, and try to get in contact with them to say, I'm caring for your loved mm-hmm. one's grave. And then not only that, there's been a group of volunteers about 15 years ago started pulling photographs of the people buried there. And so now, once a year, they have something they call Faces of Margraten. And out of the 8,000 and something buried there, they have collected over 6,000 of those photographs. And once a year, for 5 days, they display those photos next to the graves. And it's stunning. It's really amazing to witness.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a question I want to ask one of our later guests, Chris Langlois, who's written a book, because his book is sold in several different countries so far. And I've never been to Europe, and so I guess I am curious about that, the extent to which, 75 years later, those generations, now those second and third generations mm-hmm. over there, still are appreciative of what the Allies did for them to free them from the Nazi menace.
Yeah, they absolutely are. And in Normandy, you know, every time we've got veterans going over there, they go to the schools and the school children sit and listen to their stories. In Holland and in Belgium, there are people who, you know, reenactors and they participate in all kinds of ways. And when you go to Bastogne during December 15th and 16th, there's, you know, tons of ceremonies. In Normandy, we're expecting about 2 million people for this D-Day.
Tell us about the tours that you lead, conduct, okay. support,
yeah,
whichever
well,
is appropriate, all the above.
Well, I made my first trip over to Normandy 15 years ago. It was something that was very important for me to do. It took me 10 years to get my life in a place where I could do it. And when I was watching the 50th anniversary, I was like, gosh, I wish I could be there.
Mm-hmm.
I said, in 10 years, I will be there. And so at the 60th, I was there. So I spent the first few times going around and learning the history, studying the battlefields. And this will be my fifth tour that I've led. You know, it's not something I charge for. I don't charge anything for it. I pay my own way. But I'm just so happy when people want to go over there that I'm willing to take them and show them everything that I've learned. I don't know everything, like you said. You know, I consider myself a student to this day because I learn something new every time I go as well. But as a matter of fact, I just had somebody just sign on to my tour. You might know of Steve Gibson.
Oh, sure.
He's
yeah.
a late
oh,
addition.
I've got a story. I've got a Johnny Gibson story, too.
Yeah, so he just signed on yesterday to come because he really wanted to go. And I said, you know, we can make it happen. So.
Regular listeners to the show, Suzanne, have probably heard this story a million times, but I have to tell it again because I want to frame a question for you before we go to the break. Several years ago, I was in Pearl Harbor for a change of command for our USS Tucson, and I was lucky enough to have been accommodated, billeted on Ford Island. And when we're taking a tour, Admiral's boat tour of the harbor, I noticed what I thought was a bunch of trash and litter over on the beach just off of the USS Arizona Memorial. So When I got back to my quarters, I grabbed a couple of trash bags and thought, well, I'm going to go out there and pick up the litter because that's disrespectful. So I get down there. You have to kind of jump down a little wall, and I'm up down there on the sort of rocky beach. And, you know, there were some cans and bottles and stuff, and I'm picking up. But then I realize here's a sink, and here's these beams, and here's all this stuff. And it just struck me. It's like, oh, my gosh, I'm walking in a graveyard. This is stuff that was blown off the ships during that attack, and they let it be because that's the appropriate thing to do. And, I mean, the hair on the back of my neck stood up. I can imagine that that's what it's like when you're walking the beaches of Normandy or, you know, exploring Eindhoven. I mean, your restaurant was, what, right? Kind of right there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, one street away from Stratum Zine, where the 101st came in. As a matter of fact, one of the books that I brought for you, I've highlighted some pictures there that shows buildings that were right where my restaurant was. So they were all around me, and I carry their spirit with me all the time. I had pictures of veterans in my restaurant.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Suzanne Ryan, and we're going to have a couple other great guests coming up. All of us are the next generation that are supporting the retelling and the maintenance of the stories of the greatest generation. We're going to be focusing on Easy Company and the Band of Brothers. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking Easy Company, Band of Brothers here today. I'm joined in studio by Suzanne Ryan, who is just, she's a peach. Inspired by World War II history, has edited several books. I mean, you're doing a lot of stuff on your own dime that a lot of us dream about doing but haven't quite had the wherewithal to do, Suzanne. So thanks so much for what you're doing for us. Real quick, before we go to our next guest, you've got a special event coming up I want our listeners to know about. Tell us real quick about what you've got going on this coming weekend here in Tucson.
Yeah, well, we are bringing some of the actors from Band of Brothers, including your next guest.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Okay.
To Pima Air and Space Museum. We're going to have a discussion panel, question and answer, meet and greet with the Band of Brothers. Not only Band of Brothers, but we also have the grandson of one of them. If you know the series, you know Doc Rowe. This is his grandmother, Chris Langwall, who also will be joining us on the show in a little bit. We have the son of another 506 medic from 3rd Battalion, Steve Gibson's going to be there. He's going to bring some of his father Johnny's war relics. We have one of the writers from Band of Brothers, mm-hmm. which is a really fascinating perspective. He wrote on three of the episodes, but he wrote Bastogne completely. And then we're going to have some World War II veterans there. The best part about this event is that it's free to the public.
Gotta love free.
I love free, yes.
Okay. Well, let's do this then. Since how you surprised me, and you come with the whole cast of thousands here. I think on the phone now we have Douglas Spain. Douglas is one of the actors who played a role in Band of Brothers, quite the accomplished actor, 69 acting credits, if I have that right, from IMDb. Douglas, Mr. Spain, Doug, Senor Spain, whatever we call you, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thank you. Thank you so much. How are you, Ben?
I am peachy keen. Now, you played Antonio Garcia in the series. So I'm going to just play
hello,
a little.
Hello, Suzanne.
Hi, Doug. How are you?
Antonio, or Private Garcia, maybe I should say. I want to just play a little something for you here right now. Let's see your reaction.
My name is Colonel Robert Sink. If you're not listening to American Warriors Radio, pack your gear and get out of my office.
Does that ring any bells?
Yeah. They'll die, right?
Are you going to stand up and salute?
Yeah, well, I'm in my car, so I can't.
Oh. Okay, well, okay, yeah, let's not do that. Doug, I played that particularly. Dale Dye was also an actor in the Band of Brothers series. He played the role of Colonel Sink. And I'm curious for you, I think you were in at least 7 of the episodes of the series. What kind of training did you get? I mean, was this your first role as a soldier, and what kind of a training did you get to prepare for the role in the series?
Yeah, I think in terms of production size, it was definitely the biggest. And Dale Dye was one of the first people I met when I got to Hatfield, which is over in London, just an hour north of London. And there was already some, I don't know the word, some bitterness, I think, because from the other actors, and it was because I came in 3 months after production had started, and those guys are the ones that went to boot camp for 2 weeks. So there was a bitterness is not the right word.
Did they treat you like a replacement?
They did treat me like a replacement because I didn't go to boot camp with them.
What?
I only had a couple days with Dale Dye, a.k.a. Colonel Sink, on the set because they were already filming. So they only had a few hours to just give us a run-through of everything. I was kind of hired, like I say, a few weeks prior to production.
Oh, so
that... I didn't have the luxury of getting all that training that the guys did.
So I don't know anything about films, Doug. So I guess so. That was really not by design. It's like I'm not going to show up because they're not shooting my scenes yet. You literally were sort of a last minute addition.
Correct.
Wow.
Correct.
Very interesting. Well, Suzanne says that's actually kind of appropriate given, I think, the first episode you were in, you came in as a replacement to Easy Company for your character, yeah.
Yeah. So there, that was natural, the sort of attitude and feelings toward one another was very natural and very real, close to what I think the Easy Company men experienced, or a lot of men during that time experience, because because a lot of actors would come in and film and then they would be gone. So it was literally like they were no longer around, you know, because you couldn't even really visit the set. So it did replicate in a, 10,000 degree lighter situation than the actual war. It replicated in the sense that guys would come in and, a lot of their characters didn't make it, or the characters they portrayed didn't make it, so then they would be gone. James McAvoy was like one of the replacements, and he was in there for that one episode, and then, Miller, who he portrayed, didn't survive, and so he was gone. So it was very like, and then we never saw him again, you know? So I think that the fact that they bonded with a lot of actors or the characters they portrayed, and then those people were gone, and then here would come in new guys like myself, and we had to sort of prove ourselves as actors but it was, the tone was already set, and I think it was because of boot camp that this was to be taken at the utmost seriousness and respect, you know?
Now, Doug, I think they call that method acting, but you're the expert, I'm not. So, but that leads me to...
It was different. It was different. There was this weight that we all carried, and it wasn't... It wasn't for HBO. It wasn't for Tom Hanks. It was for the men of Easy Company.
So
we had to honor them.
Let me ask you that question. In reading the script, or maybe you're on set, was there a moment for you where it sort of struck you, where you're like, damn, this, like, for example, the Why We Fight episode where Easy liberated that concentration camp, and what a powerful, powerful episode that was. But as an actor, as you're going through this, was there a moment where it just sort of dawned on you the gravity of what these men
did?
Every day,
because like I said, when I would be in the ditches and stuff, I would think about Tony, and I would in the trenches, and I would say, to myself, I'm like, I know that I'm gonna go back to my home or my home in London. But I always wondered, you know, he did it. He never knew when he was, none of them did. No one knew when the war was going to be over. There was no social media, you know, there was nothing. There was no access to anything whatsoever. So, and at the time we didn't have social media when we were filming either, but we had cell phones and, you know, we had internet where we could communicate back home, but just the idea of not being able to communicate at all to anyone.
Tony,
in the U.S.
One other thing, I'm Tony. Which one are you? See, I'm already getting confused.
Tony, you can call me Tony.
You did such a great
Garcia.
Job.
You're Garcia, right?
Yeah, that's right. We're primos.
We are. Primos.
So you did get to know, and I think most of the actors had the opportunity, if the original soldiers were still around, to interact with them. My understanding, Doug, is you came to be pretty good friends with Tony, and in fact, you attended his birthday party. I don't recall, is his 80th birthday party or somewhere down the line. Tell us about that and what that's like to walk in and meet his family and kind of be the other Tony at Tony's birthday party.
It was all just kind of overwhelming, I think, because I didn't really know what was going on. Like, I got the call, and, you know, I tell this story a lot, but the casting director, Meg Lieberman, she had never really explained to me what this was. It was just one of those things where she had all these World War II photos, big life-size pictures in her office when I was auditioning for another project of Tom Hanks. And I inquired about all the photos. She said she was doing a project in Europe. And I said, oh, I was interested. And so she brought me in. And the next thing I know, I got it. And all of a sudden I'm driving up to, you know, Northern California to visit Tony. They gave me an envelope with all his information. So it all just happened so fast that there was no time to really dwell and think about any of it. You were just sort of moving through. And I did not know the extent, because when someone tells you something, it's great. You know, you hear their story, you laugh, you cry. But then to actually then relive their story, it starts to all just come to life, you know?
Mm-hmm. You know, I can.
And so that's why for me it was with Tony, I was like, oh, okay, you did this. That's great. Yeah, wow, that's wonderful. You know, I was learning. And then I was living his life.
And I can tell you, every now and then I'll run across some pictures of Tony in my research and I'll text him to Doug, and I can hear the emotion in his voice when he sees a picture of him.
Doug, I tell you, I know you're in traffic, probably L.A. traffic or someplace dangerous, so we're going to let you go real quick. But lastly, how did your role in that film inspire you? And tell us about the kinds of things you're continuing to do to spread the messages about the amazing things that, whether they're World War II veterans or some of our more modern-day veterans, are still doing for the rest of us.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I want to make a correction. It's a series, not a film.
Okay.
So a 10-part series, and for me, it was very clear that this was not a project as an actor from the get-go. It was just very different, and it has changed my life because it was definitely a life experience that I will never forget, that none of us will ever forget. And the fact that I'm, you know, 19 years later, going to the 75th anniversary in Normandy with people I have met because of the series, people who follow the series, people like Susan who is, you know, goes around and educates people about it and takes a lot of veterans back to Europe to take them back to the places they were last during the war. Like, all this stuff is still 19 years later a big part of my life. So it wasn't like I did this project and it was not an actor's project. It was, I don't know how to explain it. It was a once in a lifetime experience that still changes my life. It affects my life every year.
And
that's thanks to Tony. That's thanks to Tony and the rest of the men of Easy Company. Tony has, you know, that's the weirdest thing is I think he was in those trenches and never did he imagine that he was going to affect the life of some actor in Los Angeles for 20 years of his life almost. You know, it's 20 years of my life.
Doug, I tell you what, I can hear the passion in your voice, and that's very clear. We've got to go to break here to pay for this, but last thing, what I'm not against shameless promotion. What should folks look for you in coming up soon?
Well, they should definitely come to Tucson and meet me there with Suzanne. It is a free event, and that's one of my favorite words. So please come there. You can look me up on IMDb, Douglas Bain, or Facebook. I always am very friendly on Facebook. And get to know other stuff. I just want to focus on Band of Brothers and Tony Garcia. I love him greatly. And thank you, Susan, for this. And thank you for continuing your mission on educating people of the Second World War. These men were courageous. They went into something that they just didn't know. And to this day have affected so many lives.
Doug, thanks for spending some time with us. We look forward to meeting you. Folks, you can meet Douglas Fain and two other actors, Mark Lawrence, who played William Dukeman, and Renee Moreno, who played Joseph Ramirez, Saturday, May 4th, 2 p.m., Pima Air and Space Museum. You need to pre-register at easycofoundation@gmail.com. We'll be right back. Gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking the Band of Brothers, specifically Easy Company. There's a great event coming up this coming weekend here at Pima Air and Space Museum. You'll hear a little bit more about that. But next, we're joined by another gentleman who's got a not direct tie, but maybe a closer tie to one of the, I almost said character, to one of the real men featured in Band of Brothers. His name is Chris Langlois. He is the grandson of Eugene Doc Rowe, who was one of Easy Company's medics. Chris, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Well, it's so great to be with y'all. Hello from Dallas.
And Chris, let me just entree this because we might get to a little bit. You are Doc Rowe's grandson, but you're also a Dallas police officer.
I am. And so if you hear a little background noise, I'm just finishing up a little deal we did today with the DEA, so I'm just riding my squad car here. So I'll pull over here in just a second. I can eliminate some of this road noise.
Okay, in Arizona, it's against the law to – oh, never mind. Don't get me started. Let's let's talk about your grandfather. You, Chris, you've got a new book out called How Easy Company Became a Band of Brothers. It's a passion project for you. What I find interesting, though, is you never really talked about this with your grandfather very much, correct?
Correct. Yeah. When the book came out in 92, I was a sophomore, a junior at LSU, and I came home one Sunday to get some of Mama's cooking and to wash my clothes like a good college student. And my mom handed me the book, and she goes, "Your papa jumped on D-Day." So being a good college student, I turned to the back of Band of Brothers, and Roe is mentioned on three pages. Of course, I read those three pages in about 2 minutes, and I snapped the book closed and handed it back to her and thought, well, obviously he didn't do anything in the war. So needless to say, Roe was the only medic who made it from D-Day to Hitler's Eagle's Nest without being off the line. So he was the only medic that made it all the way through. So he did a lot, and I didn't know what I didn't know.
And correct me if I'm you're a law enforcement officer. I'm just a guy who's got access to the internet, so we can tell right off the bat that there's probably not going to be complete accuracy here. Your grandfather quit school in elementary school. He enlisted in 1942. He didn't have, like I said, he quit elementary school. He had no formal training, but he was a made a combat medic and really embraced, and based on what I can take from the series, I stand corrected, it's not a film, he was very good, and he saved a lot of lives while risking his own.
You know, it's a And I wish I knew if he volunteered to be a medic or if he was told, because I've some of the medics got to choose that position and some of them didn't. So, but from every man that I've talked to, just said he was just there. I had the chance to sit down with Brad Freeman at another book signing in Louisville a couple months ago, and Brad is a very quiet guy, very quiet. So we're just sitting there, and we're not saying anything, and just out of the blue, he goes, "You know, it was like your pawpaw was right next to him when they got hit. He was just always there." And to be a medic, I think that says a lot. If you're just always there for the men, you're always right there, Johnny, on the spot at their time of life or death, I think that says it all about the guy.
Well, and you're probably familiar being a police officer with the phrase voluntold.
Sure.
So maybe
sure.
It was one of those situations. Now, I also read, Chris, that, and again, I don't know to what extent you really got to know or hang out with your grandfather, but I've also read that he was much rougher and tougher than perhaps his character was portrayed in the series. Can you
comment? Yeah, and it's true because, you know, my entire life he wore a cowboy hat and he wore cowboy boots. And I always remember him being in the dirt business. He always had what we call dirt pits. So along the Comeet River, he had bulldozers and backhoes, and he loaded sand and gravel out of these dirt pits along the river and loaded them back into, you know, 18-wheelers and things like that for construction projects. So he was always dirty. He was always outdoors. He always had a tan face and tan arms from being in the sun all the time, and he always wore his cowboy boots and cowboy hat. You know, he was a tough guy. He spent his entire career in some way, shape, or form in the construction business. So, yeah, that's how I remember.
Now, he kind of traced the lineage for me here. Are you the product of his first marriage? Or a descendant,
yeah,
I should say, of his first marriage?
Yeah, he didn't have any kids from his second marriage.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I found it interesting. Apparently, his first wife, your grandmother, a British woman by the name of Vera, is typical in that generation, particularly those at war, where we met, let's get married, well, and then the war kind of interrupted things. As I understand it, Chris, they were married kind of a quick wedding, a taxi driver and some other guy they didn't know were the witnesses, but their wedding gifts, forks and knives from the Eagle's Nest as wedding presents.
Yes,
that's
sir.
Pretty cool.
Yes.
Is that accurate? It was on
cool.
The interweb.
It is, you know, and in fact, Rose stood her up for the first wedding date. They planned it for June 6th, 1944, which, as you know, he was slightly detained and left her literally standing at the altar with the family. So when he came back from Normandy, they got married. And yes, we have 10 forks and 10 knives from somewhere around the Eagle's Nest. It's got that ivory handle. If you watch the miniseries, they use some of the same. It looks just like the ones we have. So that's a pretty cool gift.
That's good to know. I tell you, I've had lots of actors and other folks who have played. Well, I should say I've had a number of people, for example, Tig Tegan, who was one of the 13 Hours of Benghazi, one of the guys that was actually involved then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes you ask them, okay, how accurate was the film or the series to what actually happened in real life? And his answer was not bad, you know, 60%. Usually the accuracy level is just like, well, yes, there is a country called Iraq, and yes, I was there. And that's about as accurate as they got. So, Chris, it's good to hear that kind of information. Do you one of the things your grandfather did was not only treating his own soldiers who were wounded, but years ago we had an interview with a woman by the name of Muriel Engelman, who was a nurse at the Battle of the Bulge. And one of the stories she loved to tell, she was of Jewish faith, and one of the stories she loved to tell is when she went in there to treat a Nazi prisoner, she always made sure her dog tags were very visible so that they could see that a Jewish woman was working to save their life. Did your grandfather ever share any stories about treating folks other than our own soldiers or maybe his time at the concentration camp?
You know, that's a good question. I don't have anything specific. Obviously, he would have had to have been there at the concentration camp. So he would have been at the front of that process. There's no doubt about it. My mom and my aunt and uncle, you know, when the series came out, we learned about Rose service just like everybody else in the world learned. We learned at the same time as everybody else. And they said, you know, the only thing he told us was the funny things or the good times or you know, with his friends and, you know, like Spina and things like that. He never mentioned anything bad. You know, we'd have never known that he was right there when Allie got hit, you know, with shrapnel from, you know, in Holland, or when Garnier lost his leg. But, you know, we talked to those guys, and Garnier said, your grandfather was right there. Allie said the same thing. Your grandfather was right there. You know, not about any of the bad stuff, just the few good times that he would mention.
Fair enough. Chris, tell us about a little bit more about your book, How Easy Company Became a Band of Brothers. I heard that you really consider this a passion project, and that really struck me, because American Warrior Radio is a labor of love for me personally as well, so I get that. How did you go from a college sophomore who only read 3 pages in Stephen Ambrose's book to, I need to write this story, I need to tell this story to more people?
You know, probably 4 or 5 years ago, when we started to really lose the guys, and, you know, you're looking at the horizon where we will only have the stories, we won't have the men. And I had the idea to create some sort of PowerPoint or something that anybody in the family, or really anybody at all, could walk into a classroom and say, let me tell you a story about some guys from World War II in an hour, and get students really interested in World War II, and get them interested in these stories. And so I stewed on that idea, and I'm not a technology guy, so I knew I was in over my head. And one day it just clicked. Hey, let me just write a book. I know the story pretty well, and let me just put some words down on paper. And I wanted it to be illustrated so I could draw, you know, students in. And I thought I could do it in 2 months. It took me a year and a half.
Chris, we're going to talk more about that. Hopefully you're pulled over safe to the side of the street. You checked your six. We'll be right back, folks.
Yes, sir.
Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking Easy Company and the Band of Brothers. I'm joined by Suzanne Ryan here in studio, and on the horn we have Chris Langlois, who is the grandson of Easy Company paramedic Eugene Doc Rowe. You can meet all of these folks, including several of the actors and one of the writers on the Band of Brothers series, this Saturday, May 4th, 2 p.m., Pima Air and Space Museum, 6000 East Valencia Road. Admission is free, thanks to a generous, well, go ahead and say his name, Suzanne.
The son of Boompa.
The son of Boompa. If you're a Tucsonan, you'll know. If you're in Phoenix, listen to this, you won't get it. But a very generous donor has made it free of charge. The event, again, starts at 12. The doors open at 12. The event starts at 2.
Right.
Doors open at 12. You do need to register. We need to know how many folks are coming. Send an email to easyco@foundation@gmail.com. Chris, coming back to you, we're going to take a risk here and have both you and Susan on the horn. And one of the things I hear about your book are very often, it's an illustrated book, but it's not a children's book, correct?
That's correct. And I can't claim to be smart enough to think that I was going to be able to pull that off, so I won't take any credit that's not due. But, you know, I've had an 80-year-old lady from the Netherlands say, I loved your book. And then I've had the parents of seven-year-olds say they want to read, Chris, they want to read your book every night. They call it the war book, which I think is really cute. But so if I could reach 7 to 80, I'm ecstatic. I'm completely happy with that. There's, for the fans who have watched the series, there's some things in there that you haven't read. For somebody who's never watched the series, it's a fantastic introduction.
Well, Chris, I was teasing Suzanne here. I literally have watched every episode of the series maybe 20 times. I mean, I could recite I could recite it myself. But one of the things I found interesting, this book is selling in numerous countries. I asked Suzanne this question earlier, but are you getting any feedback from whether they're second generation or third generation folks in some of these European countries, the Netherlands, France, Belgium, to some extent maybe even Germany, who are grateful for the things that men like your grandfather did to free them during the Second World War?
That's an awesome question. It's I know that it's in 17 countries, and which is amazing. There's a lady on the internet from Austria, and very proud to share the stories of World War II from all the countries, not afraid to touch on the fact that her country was part of the problem. And so, yes, you know, generation, you know, two and three generations down. People can talk about it, share the stories, and share the lessons learned. There's obviously plenty of lessons to be learned. We can't go back and have a World War III. So, yes, it's been very touching to have people say, you know, I'm from a country where we did some bad things, but I want to make sure that the next generation learns. And she's been very adamant to share my book and say, you know, the younger generations have got to learn that what our forefathers did was completely wrong, and they need to know it. And there's stories to be told from these heroes who helped liberate our country.
Suzanne, it's interesting. I'm sitting here in the studio listening to you and listening to Chris. And, you know, we heard from Douglas Spain, one of the actors. And what I'm hearing is sort of a coalition of passion. None of us involved in this conversation had, other than Chris, had a direct connection to these men, to Easy Company, or the hundreds of thousands of others like them that served. But I'm so grateful to you for putting this together so we can just have one, you know, people out there can get one more bite at the apple to hear about these things and why it's important, as Chris mentioned.
Right. Thank you very much. Part of the problem for me is I don't know who's designing our school's curriculums right now, but the amount of this history that's being taught is waning, and it's incumbent upon those of us that do care about it, whether we have a direct connection or not, to keep talking about it, to keep educating the future generations. Otherwise, we're going to lose it forever, and it's exactly what Chris said. There's so many lessons that we can't lose from that war in that time period.
Chris and Suzanne both, it's interesting. I used to get my hair cut at a barbershop in downtown Tucson called Johnny Gibson's. And I was probably about four episodes into the Band of the Brothers series, and I'm down there getting my hair cut, and here's Johnny over in the corner. He's looking through this thing that looks like a yearbook. And so I went over after I got my hair cut, and I said, Johnny, what are you looking at? And he started telling me the story about his role. And here's the real people. You know, I asked him about about the captain there at Kurahi, and was he really a jerk? He's like, oh yeah, he was a complete jerk. And to be that close to actually touch and talk to that veteran, oh my gosh! I mean, it was so amazing. Do you, when you're out there talking to particularly young people, do you still see a little bit of light come up in a pair of eyes on occasion?
You know, I got invited to career day at a school, an elementary school. And so the lady said, my son loves your book and I want him to come, but I want you to come in uniform because I want you to talk about being a police officer, but I want you to talk about your book. And I thought, this is going to be about 2 minutes about World War II. And then every boy is going to want to know, is that your gun? Is that your taser? And so I kind of went in with a little bit of a jaded view, and I was completely taken aback by these students, elementary kids who knew it was in the 1940s. A lot of people died. And I was like, and I was taken aback. And so I had four classes. And the last question of the last class, if you've seen my book, the last page is the crosses in Normandy, the cemetery. And I asked the teacher, can I ask them about the crosses? And she says, yeah, they're old enough. They know people die. So I held up the picture of the crosses in the cemetery. And I said, who can tell me why these men died? And one little boy raised his hand, and he said, they die for us.
Wow.
And I started crying. And I'm going to cry right now. I mean, I started crying because I was taken aback that these kids, somebody gets it. I said, I want to meet your parents because your parents are doing a great service to you. You get it. So, yes, if we get the message out, these younger generations get it.
You know, speaking of Johnny Gibson, I was just in his son Steve has a room with all his father's war relics. He kept a lot of stuff. And I was leafing through one of his photo albums, and in there was a photo of Tony Garcia with Johnny. They had been on a tour together back in 1999, so I immediately snapped photos of it and texted it to Doug. And so the connection, I always say this about Tucson, we don't have 6 degrees of separation here. We have one, maybe maybe two. But the emotion also that Doug wrote back when he sees those photos of him. So I'm really excited for those two to get to meet.
We may be 110 degrees in the summer, but only 1 degree of separation. Chris, following up on your comment, one of the another guest I'd had on the show is Herschel Woody Williams. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He was
Yes, sir.
A Medal of Honor recipient on Iwo Jima. And through his foundation, that's what he focuses on, is going out now and talking to these young people and spreading the messages about their civic duty and the history. Chris, folks obviously can come meet you next weekend down here in Tucson. What about 2 minutes left? Other messages you want to share with our listeners right now, if you don't mind?
You know, the guys from Easy Company got a lot of attention, worldwide attention. And there was a little bit of flack from some of the other units, especially in the 506, that, you know, Easy Company won the war by themselves if you watch Band of Brothers. And that sentiment was never, never echoed by any of the guys from Easy. They're the first ones to say, we were right next to Fox Company in Bastogne, and we intermingled with the 502nd and things like that. So the idea that that Easy Company won the war is silliness from the men's standpoint. They were very proud of their service. They loved the fact that they made a difference. They loved the men they served with for the rest of their lives. It never left them. But they liked that it brought attention to all the veterans. And in 2001, when I went over, I owned Band of Brothers, and that was the only World War II book that I owned. And now I own 100 books about World War II. So it opened up a lot of people to learn more about these men. And I hope that my book could be part of that for someone else, that it's their first book, and then it sparks them and springboards them into the world of all these heroes that we just love. Woody Williams is another great example.
Chris, thank you so much. I look forward to meeting you, Suzanne.
That's a good point, Chris. We do this event not only for the Band of Brothers, but for all of the veterans that served.
And there you go, folks. Again, you can meet all the folks we've talked about here today on May 4th, 2 p.m., Pima Air and Space Museum. It's free of charge. The doors open at noon. You can come by, probably maybe even get some photos, learn a lot. A lot of folks that are going to be there we didn't mention today. You do need to register easycofoundation@gmail.com.
If I may make one little point, we're not going to turn anybody away who didn't get a chance to pre-register. We prefer it. It'll help check in go faster, but we're absolutely not going to turn away anybody that wants to come.
Super. And, Chris, one more thing I have to share. Thank you so much for what you're doing wearing the badge. I know you went down to Baton Rouge for the funerals of three of the police officers killed down there. So thank you for you and that thin blue line, brother.
I appreciate you. Look forward to seeing you, sir.
There you go, folks. Another great show. You can find this and all our podcasts, AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Follow us on Facebook, American Warrior Radio, at Warrior Radio TUC on Twitter. And check out Patreon.com/AmericanWarriorRadio, PATREON. If you'd like to help us spread these messages, for less than one cup of coffee a month, you can help us expand to other markets. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, this has been your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. All policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.